Hi, and welcome to the Ready for Polyamory podcast. My name is Laura Boyle, and I'm your host. As usual, we're here to talk about all sorts of different topics, non-monogamy and polyamory related. Today, I'm here with an episode that's a little bit out of the archives. I recorded this episode with Evie Lupine last fall, and it never ended up getting released, so here it is for you now. We talk about all kinds of topics, ranging from the collapse of the network formerly known as Twitter and the ways that that has affected the social media landscape to the various collapses of different social media and the ways that sex education and kink education have moved from place to place because of that to various sort of interests of ours and the way that non-monogamy has been colored because of it. Evie also discusses her experience as an asexual member of the polyamorous community and the kink community and the different ways that that is received in each of those communities. And I think that this episode is a pretty valuable sort of take on both of those things. I hope you enjoy. But thanks for coming and thanks for chatting with me. So I know we were going to sit and try to talk a little bit about sort of the various ways that different platforms have been censoring and demonetizing and in various ways impeding people from talking about sexuality and adult subjects of any kind on the internet, both in educational and entertaining ways, or the ways that they sort of make you reframe your content to make it seem, I'm going to put it in the biggest scare quotes possible, more educational, no matter how educational it is in the first place.
Yes. Right?
So I don't know how to phrase this as a question. Like, can you give us a little bit of a framework of like how things have changed in the time that you've been doing this educational work online?
Yeah, I mean, I've been on various social media doing stuff as Evie Lupine, like not just like, you know, a random high schooler, like having a Facebook account or whatever, like as an attempt to be an educator. I started on Instagram, and that was, gosh, I was probably, I started that like maybe 7.5, 8 years ago. And then I got on YouTube shortly after that. And then probably about 4 years ago or whenever, like, oh, actually the Tumblr apocalypse, because that was like a huge thing. I experienced the Tumblr apocalypse and then I moved on to Twitter. I haven't been on TikTok. So that's like the one thing I don't really have a lot of personal experience dealing with censorship over. But, you know, back in the day, I think this is before Instagram got bought by Facebook, it was a little bit of a wild west of kink content. Like, you could kind of openly post about and use hashtags that included things like BDSM or kink and be pretty open about like showing toys. Like, I mean, even back then, you know, you couldn't really show like full on bare genitals or like, you know, I think what is a reasonable boundary content wise for an app that can be used by anybody who's 13 plus. And at the time, at least, there weren't as many ways to restrict your profile to make sure that wasn't being seen by people that you didn't want to have see that content or wasn't age appropriate for them. So I originally just experienced it as like, it, you know, there were some, I think, reasonable restrictions, but it wasn't necessarily too intense. And then Instagram got bought by Facebook, and then they instantly started cracking down more and more and more over the years around what kind of content you could post and what you could say, hashtags you could use. Like, shadow banning was a really big thing on Instagram, where if you use certain hashtags or keywords too often or at all, like, no one would be able to see your post, or it would kind of, it seemed like what would happen is if you said certain words too many times or if you used too many hashtags on new posts, at least, you would end up getting flagged by Instagram system as like, oh, this is an account that's probably too adult for our platform now. And then it was a crapshoot of like not knowing on a daily basis whether or not you'd still have an account, because you could just wake up one day and you'd post something that you've posted a million times over the last 4 or 5 years, and then suddenly that's something that gets your account banned or deleted. Like, I actually A long time ago, I actually had a second Instagram account that I used just for like patron only content. And that was the first time I ever had an account on social media just like straight up deleted because I was sharing, it was a private account. I was sharing stuff that was similar to what I'd post on something like FetLife, for example, which is like kinky Facebooks, which typically you're going to get more intense imagery on there than you would on other social media. And I thought it was okay because it was a private account, but it still got reported, still got flagged, still got deleted. And after that, I was so scared of what could happen to my main Instagram account, which I've had since basically the start of my kink journey. I think I made my account maybe like 4 or 5 months into exploring BDSM because I discovered that there was a pretty sizable pet play community on Instagram at the time, and I wanted to be a part of that and just explore what it was like to be a kinky person online. And it's sort of a memory box for me of like I posted a bunch of stuff that it's 5 phones ago, it's from a computer I don't own anymore. Like if that Instagram is gone and I can't recover it, it's just gone. So I ended up just like not posting anything, no pictures, no hashtags, no keywords. And it really has seemed like Instagram in the last couple of years, like the last year or two especially, it's become a little bit like how I think TikTok is supposed to be. It's become very, you have to censor all your words, you have to use euphemisms, you can't like basically post anything that looks obliquely kinky. Like you can't post a picture of a toy, you can't post lingerie, you can't post all these things that it's funny because of course, as we all know, you get advertisements for things that contain just as much bare skin. There are many accounts that are either for brands or for more mainstream vanilla influencers that post just as risque, if not more risque, visual content, and it's fine because they're bigger and make the site money. And that's really crappy. But that's just my experience on Instagram. I have like an experience basically everything else.
Right. I would absolutely agree with that. Like, as somebody who teaches kink classes and gets my advertisements for those classes, if they're not completely flat, like, there's no images in this. It is a, there are some words on a screen taken down instantly off of my Instagram. I agree with that. Right. And all of my hashtags have to be about, like, sideways words about it, right? Like, I can misspell things and I can do this and that, but you can't even misspell the correct keywords because if you misspell the correct keywords, those are already flagged.
Oh, sure.
Oh, right? Like, Instagram has gotten wise to the most common misspellings, not for like on a slide, right? Like in your stories or on a slide, you can do the most common misspellings, and that's how you avoid getting flagged by using those terms. But in the hashtags, those hashtags are already flagged.
Which
So
is, it's, yeah.
it's the whole thing is over the top to me, but part of it is that Meta bought it, right? And Meta as a company is like, let's be Zuckerberg's imagination of what 13-year-olds should consume at this point, right? And that's a whole other issue. But between that and the SESTA-FOSTA stuff, it's a world, right? The Tumblr apocalypse is in and of itself because of those rules.
And it's crazy to think about the Tumblr apocalypse as like a retrospective event now that we're like reflecting on. Like it's like some kind of personal, like tragic thing that happened to like members of the kink community. And I, from what I understand, people have gone back to Tumblr. A lot of people have, and it's like everyone's like, yeah, all the bombs dropped and now it cleared everything out. Now it's fun and nice again. And like there are people who seem to have built up like better communities on Tumblr, which is great, but like I sort of have a mentality of like, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. Like, I'm not gonna dedicate time to a platform that just blew up so extremely. Like, I, when I was on Tumblr, I, because I'm asexual, I think I had a little bit of a different relationship to it than a lot of people did. And it affected me in a unique way. Cause sort of if people who are listening don't know what the Tumblr apocalypse was, because you weren't on the website or don't know what it is. Essentially what happened is like overnight, Tumblr decided, okay, no more adult content. We're gonna like have an AI like remove all of this adult content and nudity, and it tanked the website because Tumblr was sort of like how Twitter, at least somewhat recently, was like in the last couple of years, where like you could rather openly have nudity, sexuality, porn clips. Like people had whole porn blogs they would share with their partners just to like reblog, sexy things to like get their partner in the mood, or to like save it as an idea for later or whatever. And so
Pinterest of porn.
there was a really big community on there for that. Also for like very niche kinks that like I don't even know how much their communities have recovered, because like Tumblr was the place. Like if I'm not gonna like enumerate all the various kinks, but there were a lot of little corners you get into for things like pet play and ABDL, but like fetish content too, that just doesn't really have a direct home anymore. Where if you're like a younger person, young adult who's like kind of coming to terms with the fact that they have a balloon fetish, like you could go on Tumblr and you could find content about it from people who also shared your fetish and get support through that, as opposed to like, I don't even know where you'd go now for stuff like that. But all that aside, they just terminated all this stuff and it was handled very poorly. You had people getting posts deleted and removed left and right that had nothing to do with the actual ban itself. Like, a photo of an orange would get misread as like a picture of an ass and then it would get deleted. And I primarily used it actually not for like porn or nudity or anything, but I used it as like a Q&A thing. Like I would have people anonymously send me questions through there, and I had hundreds and hundreds of both questions I never got to answer and ones that I had already answered, like in a fair amount of detail, it just like disappeared. And I was able to like download an archive of my entire Q&A basically, but there's just not anything to like upload it to that has a similar format. And it was really crappy to lose that method of like people being able to interact. Because like I do live streams, but it's not quite the same thing as, the comfort of anonymity of getting to ask and know that you're not going to have a name attached to that, that it's just going to be something you can throw off into the night and not have to worry about your identity being
Right, there
attached to.
was some comfort in it being like the post secret of platforms. I don't know if I am maybe dating this to my podcast listeners. If you don't remember post secret, you're not millennial enough for this reference. But like it was a thing on the internet that was kind of a blog where like somebody would post notes that people would send on postcards and they were supposed to be of secrets, right? But that thing of a Q&A and it being super anonymous is valuable, right? We like to be able to share these things in the quiet and the dark. And all of these anonymized platforms, and like, okay, here's a question box and it won't show me who you are, only kind of works so far.
Yeah, nothing's really replaced that feature, at least from anything I've seen and used. And people will use other platforms for that, but I think Tumblr kind of combined the best of both worlds, where people who already knew you could go to your Tumblr and ask questions through there. But because of reblogging and everything else, like people would natively find your content on Tumblr through reblogs, through other people quoting you and sharing your content. And I, from my understanding, at least a lot of the current Q&A platforms, I mean, there's Quora, I guess, but that's not really anonymous. But most of them, like, it's you go there because you have a link to that person's page on that website. You're not like organically finding people that are like educators through it. You're not discovering new people. And I think that's really the sad part about all of this. And maybe I'm sort of biased because I am a content creator and this is my job, but it is sad that it's just harder to connect to people and find people online that you appreciate their voice, or they have a unique perspective, or they just say things that you find interesting, or post pictures you find engaging, or whatever. Like, it's so much harder to find that now because of how much content is restricted. Like, it's hard to find anything that's not like completely vanilla, like safe for work content, even when you want to find things that are
Well, right, because
different.
it's all algorithm based and the algorithm is pushing away all of these things, right? It's deprioritizing anything that it deems to be adult content.
Yeah. Well, that's actually the interesting thing about YouTube. In YouTube, I could write a 2-hour long like movie script about the journey that is like monetization and censorship on YouTube, because I
I
think
look
it's,
forward to the video.
yeah, it's like, wait, do I post it on YouTube or does that like, will YouTube be mad at me for that?
I look forward
But
to them demonetizing the video on demonetization.
I know, but there are other content creators that have done, at least at the time, very thorough deep dives, but it's such a black box. It's hard to know what's really going on anyways. I mean, they all are, but I think with YouTube, it's particularly egregious because like people don't make money off of Twitter or Tumblr directly the way they do with YouTube. And so it's like, okay, well, they're making a business decision and, you know, the people that are on the website are sort of the, strangely enough, despite the fact that they're the users, are also
The
the,
product.
yeah, they're the product and they're just sacrificed essentially for the bottom line when a company's being bought and sold. But with YouTube, it's strange because it's like you're paying me, but then also making this very like it's so bizarre. But with YouTube, I recently had an experience where I did a video that was reacting to a Reddit story from, I don't remember what subreddit it was on now. I think it was Today I Fucked Up. And it was a story that somebody had posted about like a BDSM scene gone wrong. And it was about CNC, which is consensual non-consent. And I like slightly censored some swear words because YouTube's very, very anti-swear word now. Like I couldn't say the word fuck out loud during the whole video. That drove me nuts. But I was able to talk the whole video about CNC and the video got monetized and it performed amazingly. Like it's reached outside of its normal audience for my videos. It got recommended. And I almost wonder if it's because it's Reddit content and it's like sort of a, like reacting to bad things happening to other people, which is a very separate category from like educational, let me teach you about this. And it's funny to me that like if I upload a video where I talk about dollification or whatever, that gets demonetized, but then I make a video reacting to like a bad time somebody had and trying to make that an educational discussion, not just like, oh my God, look at the freak show. It's just like it's funny that like something that I was sure was gonna get fully demonetized didn't. And in fact, YouTube seemed to really like it, specifically, I think, because the content was more negative and therefore more engaging. Like at least superficially, the way the algorithm would read it, it came across as more negative content. I don't think I made it negative content in practice with the way I was
So what
discussing
I'm
it.
hearing is you need to make it a dollification gone wrong video in order to make sure it stays monetized.
Exactly. I need to, which is funny because YouTube on the back end, they sort of have like a second version of their monetization guidelines. They will show creators when you are trying to appeal like a monetization status or just look for more information. Like you kind of get a broad strokes overview in like Google forums and stuff that they will link to. But then when you actually like, you know, get out the magnifying glass and a fine tooth comb and look through all of it, they have a specific criteria in their demonetization guidelines where you can't talk about personal experiences related to fetish and kink content. You actually can't even say the word fetish. I discovered through some testing that there are like three words that if you put it in the thumbnail or the title, it would just automatically either age gate or restrict your video. And it would be sissy, cuckold, and fetish are the three words I've seen so far that do that, which I think some of them are because they're insults, like in a non-kink context. And I just find fetish to be interesting, but I think the reason why is I have to remember that a lot of the content that gets uploaded to YouTube is not educational, right? Like if you were to go through YouTube and you were to search for bondage and sort by newest, the vast majority of what you're gonna see is like re-uploaded, specifically like Chinese and Asian like pornography that's like stolen from some other porn website. And that's like 99 out of 100 videos you find searching for bondage are gonna be that, or they're gonna be like a Christian preacher talking about freeing yourself from bondage in like a totally different context. So very, very little of it is actually educational. A lot of it is either literally just porn or it's ASMR that really kind of skirts the line of being auditory porn essentially, or it's dominatrixes that are trying to use YouTube as a marketing strategy essentially, where they'll make a video that looks like it's going to be educational. I've watched a couple of them, and then you realize with the way they're talking and the way the camera is positioned and how they're dressing. It's just a sales funnel to get you to go to their clips for sale or whatever, Sext Panther or whatever. And I find that very unfortunate. And I never want to belittle anyone that is in the sex industry and doing this as a profession because it is very difficult and they are providing a service. But doing that kind of content where you're kind of trying to wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and get her on YouTube guidelines and through that make fetish content that people are enjoying for more than just the educational experience, that's kind of screwed the rest of us that are making directly educational content because YouTube's AI is not good enough to be able to tell the difference between a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, this is sexy, sexy content versus like actually educational content. They're not that refined
Well, so
yet.
on TikTok, what you get is the cooking shows that aren't cooking shows, the
Tell me
blatantly
more.
pornographic cooking content.
Oh,
It's
no.
all just squishing and stomping and
Oh,
hands, or like people with nails done like mine, but they're touching food and they're touching specific food.
so it's like very, it's like specifically like fetish content.
Right.
Okay, that's
The
so
fetish
interesting because
content on TikTok that isn't labeled that way, right? But it's tagged
fascinating.
by what food it is,
So if you
right?
want to see a woman step on raw chicken,
Right.
love in
Or
a
if you
sexy
just
way.
want to watch like hands massage specific foods,
Oh, okay.
or like
That's so
today we're
interesting.
going to make a, and then it's just watching somebody open things and touch them and whatever. And there's no recipe coming out at the end of this, probably.
Yeah.
Or what comes out looks absolutely inedible because there was no process here. But
Yeah.
like the process is clearly fetish content. But they would
Yeah.
never, they can't say that. It's
Yeah.
TikTok. But we all
Yeah,
know
they
it, right?
Yeah.
And the first 20 seconds, you can't be sure because they're just opening cans or whatever. And they could just
Yeah.
have just gotten their nails done. But
I almost wonder if maybe because like I think a lot of that stuff, if it's like it how it is on YouTube, it's like mass produced by like content farms. And so maybe they have some knowledge just from like sheer volume of accounts and uploading daily that they figured out, okay, if we don't do this until like X number of seconds into a video, like it's fine, it gets past the censors or they don't care about it or something. Because I don't know how like TikTok censorship works, but there was very similar content for a long time on YouTube that was a lot of like crushing fetish videos and definitely stuff where it's like it's a woman in like a micro mini skirt and like a basically a bra and then maybe a cooking apron over it and then making food and like clearly it was about like the moments where she turned and you can almost see fully up her skirt and like it was meant to be erotic, but I almost wonder if TikTok's variant on it is sort of like that combination of like rage baiting that's like sort of unique to TikTok and fetish content put together. Cause like there's a whole genre of like rage bait Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok videos that are all about like, I'm gonna turn my dining room table into like a spaghetti factory and I'm gonna make 12 pounds of spaghetti noodles and then mix it by hand on my giant hardwood table. And like it's not real food making content. It's almost like but the people in it are not like the like you know how on YouTube for a long time there were like very popular videos that were like the life hack videos. Like it's almost like people that aren't like those content farms are doing rage bait life hack videos to get engagement, and some of them have added a sexual undertone to it to get more engagement.
Right. So it's like a whole second set of content farms that are like, we know which kinks we are feeding.
Yeah.
Here we
The ones
go.
that involve giant toilet bowls and large amounts of food and squishing and splashing and like all of that's like it's totally valid as like kink stuff. I find it interesting that that is apparently lucrative enough to like spam an entire website with repeatedly all day.
It's
Like,
one of
what
those
is
things that
the
like can't be a huge market for, or not a huge market. There can't be a huge amount of material for it, right? Unless people were
Sure.
making it themselves. So all of a sudden, there's all this stuff available, and people are like, oh my God, yes.
Yeah. I
I
think,
will watch, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. Like, it's, you know,
and
the
rage
meme where
bait
it's,
is very real, right?
yeah.
Like, rage bait watches are probably getting a million of them.
Yeah. Like, I've even gotten that on, like, without even trying, because I don't engage with that content. Like, it gets recommended to me constantly in, like, YouTube Shorts or on the homepage. And it's like, I don't want to watch content like this. I don't engage with content like this. And it still gets pushed because of how much other people are engaging with it. But on the other hand, it's, I feel like we're in this catch 22 where there's not really any platforms for us to go to. And I know if you're a content creator, you get told all the time, oh, well, go to Kit, go to Rumble, you can upload it in Pornhub, you can do this and that, and like you can make Vimeo, make your own platform. And it's like, oh, first of all, the expense of that would require. Also, I think most of us are trying to put our content in different baskets, and there's just not anything that has the searchability, the visibility, the engagement of other platforms. And like, Vimeo's not paying me to upload content. Like, I have to pay other places to have my content on it most of the time. And websites, you know, that are more porn focused, even that is typically very restrictive around certain fetish content. Maybe not talking about it, but like, even for things that are seemingly very mundane, like water sports, like, you're not gonna be putting that on any sort of mainstream porn platform. Like, I've seen some people share lists of like, here's what kind of content is okay on whatever different, you know, clips for sale, many vids, whatever. And you'd be surprised how many of them, even as porn websites, are so restrictive, even though they'd make tons of money if they openly allowed it. Like, a lot of hypno content is also very restricted. And like, I think that leads people to more dangerous and predatory websites because they're not on more mainstream platforms. And really, at the end of the day, what all this goes back to is it's not just like the individual machinations of whatever CEO is currently running these websites. It's credit card processors, the lobbyists that lobby the credit card processors. And really, it ultimately ends up going back to Christian fundamentalism and the way that it tries to influence our country and our politics. And they do so fairly successfully. And their disgust for things like pornography at all or adults having consensual sex, you know, they're able to kind of successfully argue, you know, we're not going to give you our business. We're not going to support you if you allow and process payments for platforms that have X kind of content. Like, it's happened to Patreon, it's happened to YouTube, it's happened to basically anywhere you can make money online. They have lobbied about it.
Absolutely. Even we mentioned FetLife earlier. FetLife doesn't allow certain kinds of content on it because they needed to maintain their relationship with credit card payment processors. I
Yeah.
remember when that was a giant kerfuffle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I
that
just because
was.
they stripped out a couple of kinds of content and people's pictures disappeared and people lost their minds about it. And like for good reason, if you suddenly lost a bunch of content, you would also probably lose it a little bit.
Yeah, like it was a combination of like a couple different things. And I think one of the other things they cracked down on too was sales, basically, like people that were either there were professionals that were doing it as a marketing tool or advertising, you know, selling panties or fetish items. And it's like, you know, like also with SestaFosta and Craigslist and everything, Backpage and everything else that's gone away over the years, like it's people aren't going to stop looking for this stuff. It's not going to go away. They're just getting pushed to other websites that are less reputable, more dangerous, more predatory, and are more likely to like steal their identity, steal their credit card information, and be full of bots that are going to take that information from you and trick you into thinking you're talking to a real person.
Yeah, it's one of these things where, like, the more that we give in to lobbyists who are pushing people into a corner with this kind of thing, the less reputable, clear educational content we have available for people, and the more people get pushed into corners and have either unreliable information or incomplete information available to them and just try things wildly, and sometimes that works out, and sometimes it puts them in dangerous positions.
Yes, like my controversial cancelable kink opinion is I think the energy that we had for like how much we collectively hated 50 Shades of Grey, we could have saved that, or maybe we could have, you know, redoubled our efforts and instead focused on like internet censorship and like how much that sucks. And now, like, now that it's been going on for so long, you know, now we're at a point where we can complain about it, but we're sort of powerless to really do anything about it. And like, that's the real boogeyman of like what's ruining the kink community. It's not 50 Shades of Grey, it's internet censorship that's making it hard to be on any of these platforms that we want to meet each other on, socialize on, and just be able to have a life where we talk about a very real aspect of what a lot of us do every
Right.
day.
50 Shades of Grey got us a bunch of new people who were very excited about sort of the wrong thing for about 2 years. That is not actually something to be worried about. The people who were actually interested in the right things figured it out pretty quickly.
And like that's what I've experienced too, is everyone I've met in the community that will sort of like sheepishly admit that they like were finally brave enough to talk to their husband about kink because they read this book and they decided they really wanted to have it in their life. Like, you know, 90% of people maybe that even got to that stage, they played around with it once or twice. You know, they got something from lovers. They went, oh, okay, it's as good as a fantasy thing, but it's not really my thing for real. Everyone else that got left behind after that, like, they ended up becoming perfectly adequate community members. It's not like there's not like a pandemic of, you know, people running around at kink conventions going, I where's, you know, Christian Grey? Why won't somebody like make me wear a braid and like spank me until I say red? Like, that's not a reality that we're facing, but we are facing a reality of like censorship, even in real life, like getting to a point where it's making things harder to organize because it's harder to find hotels that will host events. It's harder to find, you know, convention centers that are willing to have, you know, kink as something that's happening in them or at them. And our number every year of available conventions is getting smaller and not bigger. And that's, to me, that's like the really scary part. Because like online is bad itself, but like when the real life community is shrinking and going backwards, that's much harder to recover than like migrating to a new
Right. The
website.
fact that hotel chains are now sometimes refusing as a chain to do business because payment processors are being difficult, because that's a reality that's happening.
I do wonder how much that's happening because I'm not like with kink education, I'm very, very involved. I don't generally do as much of that for like polyamory related things or like more general like vanilla sex conferences. And do you know anything about that happening with like polyamory or sex related stuff, or is it more kink
So
specific?
a lot of that is happening with kink specific stuff. For sex related stuff, it's kind of sitting in the middle. If there's enough money involved and enough people with nice titles attached, right? Like if enough people with doctor next to their name are on the board of something, they'll go, oh yes, these nice doctors, therapists, scientists can have their conference.
Because
Right,
they're sex doctors, so
a
it's fine.
human sexuality conference can occur. Right, but it needs to get sold right. A wellness conference can happen. Right, but it needs to be pitched right. And so now it's turning into like you have to be a little bit pearl clutchy in the way you sell an event, and I hate that.
Yeah, I hate the dishonesty because I wish I could just be like, no, this is a sex conference because we like sex, and
And
not just
like
like, oh, it's a wellness conference for like women's empowerment
when
or
they're
what.
trying to like organize these things in general, it is very much a like, well, these are the topics we're working with, and this is the kind of clientele we have, and this is what we can pay ahead of time and what we can't. Right? And if it's a new conference, you generally need to book the whole hotel ahead of time down. Or you need to be able to go, well, this is a conference that's been running this many years, and so we can prove that we will sell out this many floors of your hotel, or we will take over the whole hotel.
And then obviously they're going to wonder if you have had a more ongoing convention history, like, why aren't you working with that hotel anymore? What happened there? Like, people in the hospitality industry talk to each other, and events and groups of people cultivate a reputation for better and for worse. And I mean, I feel like honestly, most of the time we just gotta like cross our fingers and hope we get lucky with like somebody who owns a hotel that like is very kink positive themselves and like loves it. Like there's like one convention I've been to a lot where like that's the guy. Like the whoever the head management person is for the hotel, like he's wearing his full on work uniform, but he's like walking around in the convention like so proud of himself that he like helps make this happen. And it's very
Just
cute.
being like, I booked you guys. I'm great. Yeah, no, I've been to a couple of cons where that's the vibe. Like the manager is so excited. And I've been to a couple of cons where it's just like clear that the staff is so uncomfortable, even though they like let people volunteer or not volunteer to work or not that weekend. It's like really rough sometimes, right? Because like folks can't choose where they work. And some of these events, especially if they're kink cons and hotel takeovers, often involve sort of a very different vibe than conferences that hotels often host.
Like it's much more of like a party atmosphere as opposed to like an HR conference.
Right. And so, like, that can be a little bit rough for staff.
Like I always have empathy for staff and like absolutely I've heard of conventions where attendees do not behave appropriately and make staff uncomfortable. And every single time I hear about it, I just cringe so hard inside, and I'm like, you're ruining this for us. Please do not proposition the hotel staff. Like you have, there's thousands of people downstairs that would like be open to a consent conversation, but no, you have to like make people feel even more uncomfortable when they're trying their best to be professional, and it just
And if
makes me so
everybody
mad.
behaves perfectly fine, we like live in this culture that is very straight-laced, relatively speaking, right? Like, I have mostly been to kink cons on the East Coast and in the Midwest, and like, we are from a lovely repressed part of this great country. And so, even if you get people who are like, I'm just here trying to do my job, all these crazy people around my hotel, like, you can feel the vibe coming off them of, I'm just very nervous and trying to do my job, as you're like just being friendly and walking by them and saying, hello, good morning, but like, or good evening, right? But it's good evening and you're going down to the dungeon,
Yeah, you've got a really big bag with you. And they're like,
right? You
why
have a
is
real,
everyone walking around with duffel bags?
right?
What's
Like, and it's
happening?
a takeover, so you haven't like super overdressed, right? So you're wearing like a spangly outfit and you're carrying a very big bag. And
I
they're
haven't
like,
been to
that's
too
a
many
lot of
events that are.
sequins. Like,
Yeah. A lot of sequins,
that's
lots
a
of
lot of
layers
sequins
of,
and not much else. Like,
yeah. There's a many a hotel event outfit I could describe as like sequins and lots of sheer layers. And I've been to one event that was a hotel takeover, and I feel like it was much more relaxed. A lot of them here are small enough to where they're just multiple floors as opposed to like a whole hotel. And I don't know. I really like going to conventions, and I hope they get to stick around, and I'm nervous they might not always be able to be there. But that's like one of the interesting things too, is like the cultural differences both in the scene and also how people perceive the scene that aren't part of it, like East Coast to West Coast. 'Cause like I've gone to conventions in Portland, in Seattle, in San Francisco, and like, yeah, I mean, people are relatively like, if they're not kinky, they're not comfortable necessarily with the content, but I don't feel like I'm like insulting somebody with my presence necessarily if I'm checking into a hotel and I say I'm with the event. Like usually it's sort of like mild curiosity to like, my shift is over in 45 minutes and I can't wait to be out of here. Like just sort of like normal like feeling of like just having a job. But I imagine that if I went to somewhere that was like much more conservative, generally leaning, like if I went to somewhere like in the Midwest or if I went down to somewhere in Florida or Georgia, like how much different would it be? And I'm just hoping for those conventions and that they get to stick around.
Yeah. So I guess in a little bit of a pivot, because you have a bunch of sort of life experience that I absolutely don't, that I kind of want to pick your brain about.
Sure.
Because I am the like absolute opposite of an ace kinkster. I am the person who is like, Ah, yes, kink. I love it. It is delicious. It is here for all of my play with my friends. And also, if anyone would like to have the sex after, I'm here for it. Hello. Somebody throw me an orgy, right? But like, so I want to chat a little bit about your experience in various kink scenes as an ace person, because I'm always here for validating that kink and sex don't have to be entwined, or that like that's a thing that can be separated, because I know from experience that they can be, right? Like I have play partners where that's not all one thing. But I don't have any lived experience as someone who doesn't like put those things together in my head.
Yeah, I think probably your experience is the more typical one of like it's delicious and I love it, and also like I'm not just doing this for sex reasons necessarily, but also like an orgy would be great, and you know, the sexy sex even with just like friends is nice, and that's something I enjoy. Like that's I know a lot of people like that in the scene. I would say I was sort of simultaneously discovering myself as a kinkster and then also kind of settling into the fact that I was asexual at relatively the same time. And I think I got very lucky with the culture of the scene I entered into at first. So I got started doing kink when I was at the very, very end of being in university. I was about to graduate. And there was a pretty sizable kink community that involved other people that went to my school that were right around my same age, which I think made it a lot easier to navigate versus getting into a scene where, like, maybe I'm only the only 20-year-old that's there. Because that, you know, I think that's intimidating for people. And I think we can recognize that, like, you know, maybe you don't want to have your first kink experience be with somebody who's like your parents' age. Like, that's kind of mentally weird to deal with. For a lot of folks, at least some people, like that's their kink, and that's also valid. But most people, it's like you're not, especially if you've been in school and you haven't entered into the work world yet, it's not n typical to have like social interactions with people that have that large of an age gap with you, unless they're a family friend. And this is about as opposite as you could be from like the sort of like casual distance you have with like a family friend you see at a potluck once a year. So it's interesting that it's so different for people. But for me, I entered into a scene where like sex at BDSM spaces wasn't necessarily typical. I had no idea what to expect. I didn't know. I didn't have any idea in my head of what it would be like. I kind of just went, oh, kink is a thing people do in real life. And then I went, oh, okay, great. And then I found some places to go and some groups, and I started to explore that. And I wasn't really exposed to like sex happening in a dungeon until I'd already been going to events for a while. But because I was already in the process of like coming to terms with the fact that I was asexual, that was sort of like the tail end of a process I'd been on for, you know, 2 years maybe at that point of like, you know, trying to do the more like typical college sexual experience and like trying to deconstruct a lot of my like sexual values that I was brought up with, as far as like, you know, I was raised in a relatively conservative Christian household, nothing like crazy extreme, like what a lot of people have experienced. But, you know, like, you know, sex wasn't really talked about. It wasn't a conversation. It was sort of assumed that, you know, you would generally save stuff for marriage and like you wouldn't do anything too wild before you got settled down with somebody. And so I had to like learn a lot of stuff for the first time about like pleasure and orgasm, and like all of it was so interesting to me. But then through that, trying to do the normal college party experience, I was like, oh, this is super not for me. Like, I get nothing out of this. I don't want to ever have to do this again. And so I was already kind of settled on like that not really being something I was looking for by the time I got into the kink scene. And people were like relatively like non-judgmental about it. I would say most people hadn't necessarily dealt with somebody who was labeling themselves as being asexual, but it was never an issue. Like, it was never like a, oh, that's weird that you only do it this way. Like, in any, I mean, I can't think outside of like maybe trying to find play partners like online, I have never experienced any kind of either direct or passive hostility towards being asexual in the kink scene. Like, people are understanding, they want to be inclusive. In fact, there have been more and more events recently that have included specifically in their diversity and inclusion statements, you know, asexual and aromantic people, and like wanting them to feel welcome in the kink scene. And I think that's like a really big step forward, because I know lots of ace people that are very curious about kink as sort of an alternative way to explore intimacy, that are like, am I welcome? Will it be weird? Like, will I expect to touch their genitals even if they don't touch mine? And it just like helps clear things up a little bit as far as like where the kink community stands with ace people and them being welcome in the scene or not.
Yeah, I know, like our local dungeon also, when I was sort of coming up here, had like rules about what was and wasn't allowed in terms of like what kinds of sex were and weren't allowed in the dungeon. They were somewhat limited, right? But they were limited in a way that sort of assumed that people were going to want to be having sex. And like had to be limited from doing so, right? Because of the rules of the space. And so I wondered if like you had ever run into things of like, oh, there were assumptions that people would be doing things and then were being stopped from doing it. But it seems like no, because there were rules about it. Everybody just assumed that dungeons were not specifically sex zones, they were kink zones.
I've had different experiences at different dungeons. Like when I lived in Seattle still, and like around that general area, the dungeons I went to, just the culture of them was not very sex focused, at least like pre-pandemic. And so like there weren't any rules against like, and maybe this is actually because they didn't really have a lot of restrictions over like intercourse. Like I think depending on the party, you would be expected to like, you know, use condoms, and you'd have to have a sheet, and you'd have to like bring your own, or you have to pay for one. You know, you'd be expected to like take it with you and then wash it, and yada yada. Like there were barrier protection methods to ensure that there, you know, wasn't some kind of giant outbreak that was resulted from these parties. Like they were complete free-for-alls, but as far as like specific actions, I find that I, at least from my experience, is much more based on like the laws of the municipality and like where the line is for like legally something being considered like a brothel or not, more so than like something about the event organizers or like the kink community being like, people cannot have vaginal intercourse while at a BDSM party. And so I
Which
think
is
kind of,
just the most East Coast blue law of us, right? Like, I'm in a state that until a couple of years ago couldn't sell beer on Sundays.
Oh my God. Yeah. And it's just like, well, we just never thought it was a problem before. And so, you know, why would it be a problem? Yeah, I think my experience has been like, even if there's freedom around what people can do, it doesn't feel restrictive. Like people are open to do that, but the culture of who goes to the events and who runs them, I think, tends to influence what people consider normal and typical for the kink scene. And so if the culture is that, like, you know, sex happens, but it's normally like during aftercare and kind of the aftercare area, and it's off to the side, or if sex does happen, it's part of the scene as like a, this is a way to express our power exchange, this is a way to like demonstrate something that's like kink related, as opposed to the kink itself is just having like vanilla intercourse. And I don't know how to explain that without like giving very specific examples of like scenes that I've seen or been a part of, but they are different. And so like there was always, you know, maybe one person who'd have a blowjob happen at some point during a scene, or like somebody doing something in the aftercare area, but it was definitely not the majority. It wasn't typical. It wasn't either shamed or praised. It was just part of the variance. But I think maybe partly because pickup play is very popular in a lot of these spaces, like people don't have like the comfort level, generally speaking, to be like, I'm gonna trust you with my body enough to also beat me up and then also have sex with me afterwards without having the ability to like exchange STI results or whatever. So yeah, I think it's a very much a cultural thing from like dungeon to dungeon, because now that I'm down here in Portland, the majority of spaces are either swinger owned or like are adjacent to that. They're usually connected to bars, and I think having the drinking plus the kink tends to lead to a different environment where it is much more like a swingers club. It is much more sex focused. That is, you know, a lot of people go there kind of blurring the lines between sex party and kink party, where like, sure, there will be people that are spanking and flogging and all the usual stuff, but there's a lot of people that are very openly having sex, and that's like the primary thing that people go there and do is that. And there's kind of sort of the secondary group of people that are just there for kink, but the average person, because there's not orientations, if you can pay the cover fee, you can get in the door to a lot more people that are just there for sex, even when the party theme is supposed to be like an edge play night, supposedly.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. So that sounds actually like it's a lot more in line with the kind of experiences that I had when I was living in Montreal.
Oh, yeah. It's very much more European.
Well, it just sort of sounds a lot more like there are fewer, because where I am here in Connecticut, there are lots of rules, like sort of municipality by municipality, about what's allowed in a particular space. And when we had a full dungeon here, the entire state of Connecticut currently doesn't have a full dungeon. We have a rope Aww. Studio that occasionally gets rented out as a dungeon and reset as a dungeon. It's a whole thing. And then we have parties in private homes currently.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's a whole vibe.
Yeah.
I learned a lot more about the kink scene for the 7 years that I lived in Montreal. And when I was there, certainly that kind of vibe that you were describing in that sort of first set of dungeons that you were exposed to when you were living in Seattle sounds like it sort of aligns with my experience there. And I think it very much is just kind of the culture of who's nearby and of who owns and is operating a space, right? Because as you were saying, public spaces that are more run in conjunction with swinger spaces are more likely to have that alternate focus. But yeah, so I guess I'm really glad to hear that you haven't had negative experiences of people like not treating you well. And I hope that that continues.
I think that it should. I think most of my negative experiences as a nice person have been like dating and polyamory related, not kink related.
I'm also sorry that polyamorous people haven't been nice.
It's not that they haven't been nice. It's that like
my next set of memes about shaming them. I don't know if you saw my one this week about shaming unicorn hunters out of the well.
Oh no, I don't think I got to see that one yet. But
I'll shame people who are being acephobic next.
It's like the unintentional ace phobia of polyamory is I think how I would frame it. Like it's because you get all this like crap from like books and educational resources and like people who were supposed thought leaders in this community that are like polyamory is about love and it's not about sex. But then like meanwhile you go to like basically at least in my experience any poly meetup, any discussion group, any like group of people that are identified as polyamorous, and like they look at you, they figure out who your partners are, they figure out if they can fuck you or not. And then after that, if you're not in the fuckable category, they're not interested. Because like everyone is so polysaturated that they're like, the only thing they have time for in their busy schedule is like what to them is the most important, which is not friendship, which is not other stuff. Generally, it's like somebody that I can fuck or like my partner can fuck, and like navigating to get to that experience. And like my experience of poly, Seattle, Portland, anywhere else I've visited or lived, it's like very, very, very sex focused. But it's in a way where it's like people pretend it's not. And I would just really rather people be honest about like the fact that a lot of people are drawn to polyamory because it's really nice to get to have sex with more than one person, like as opposed to putting a veneer over it. Like that's not part of it. Cause I can tell, I can see it, I can feel it in the way you interact with me.
Like it is okay to be drawn to polyamory for the sex. Here, I will write them a permission slip for it.
Yes.
One polyamory for sex for them. But like, also, if they're polysaturated enough that they're just seeking people for sex, they can admit that they would like someone to have sex with every second Tuesday. Instead of being like, I would like to make organic new connections, however those may take shape.
Yeah. Oh my God. Because, fuck, I've read that on a dating app like five times. Curiously, that always goes into sex.
Well, right. The organic new connection, however it may take shape, actually just means that they know they don't want an escalator relationship.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of like sideways communication that happens in polyamory where it's like you have to, which is weird because we're supposed to be all about communication, but then sort of you have to translate in your brain like sometimes if somebody's single, organic new connection can mean something different from like somebody who's like married and has two other partners. But at least in my experience, seeing where a relationship, you know, is going to grow, it is already kind of contained by other time and life obligations. What that really typically means is how much of that free time am I going to give you? Not necessarily like friendship versus romance versus sex. It's I do want this kind of relationship, and a relationship to me means including these factors. And am I going to see you every Tuesday or every other Tuesday? Like, what level of time commitment is there going to happen? I think is what typically is more communicated by that. But
And so you're like, okay, but I want to have an honest conversation about the amount of connection that we're going to have because I need minimum threshold this level of connection, maximum threshold that level of connection. These are available connections. They go wibbly wobbly this way, sideways.
Like
There are
I'm
many of them. We could be craft partners. We could do these hobbies. We could do those hobbies. We could go on a kink weekend. But, do you want to come with me to the convention? But, they're like, oh, but the convention sounds like it would be more fun if we also fucked. And you're like,
We
that's
have to
not what I offered.
I mean, I think it's even that, like, to unlock that level of emotional commitment, you have to have sex first, I think is really my
For a lot
problem.
of people,
It's like,
yeah.
sure, if you want to have convention hotel room sex, like, we can have a conversation about that. Because for people who don't know me, I am a sex neutral asexual. So, like, I'm not like, just very nonplussed about sex. Like, it's not a chore. I don't hate it, but it's not like my favorite thing. Like, it's neutral. It's okay. It's not the thing I organize my life around, generally speaking. So I'm like, I'm very able, though not always people are, to be accommodating towards that. But it's like people, like the polyamorous expectation of sex is like even different from vanilla culture. And I think more pressure sometimes. And like people aren't willing to go more emotionally deep with you until you've like unlocked what to them is a base feature of a relationship.
Whereas you're like, I need to unlock the base features of the relationship for me before we start getting into this feature that for me is a bonus that you unlock. And they're like,
Exactly. It's
no,
like
I
we're
need that before
backwards.
you get the bonus. And it's like, okay, then I guess we're not compatible, but that's annoying.
It is annoying 'cause like that's almost never like upfront clear from like initial conversations or dating profiles that like this is how it's going to go. 'Cause I do not have any time to waste. I don't care. I don't need to match with every possible person on a dating app. I'm very specific about like, this is what I want. This is who I am. This is what's in my life currently. Like, take it or leave it. I don't really have time for like, you know, trying to make something work that's not really actually all that compatible at the end of it. And I find that if I can't, if I, on the rare occasion that I have found people that are either like very sexually satisfied with other partners or they like have a more similar value to sex as me, that tends to work out a lot better versus like sort of my standard poly interaction, which has been people that are like, wait, you don't want to have sex after the first date? Like the whole point of the first date is it's the prelude to get to the sex. Like that's the social dance we have to perform before we can just fuck each other. And it's like I know people that that's like their mentality is like the dating, like maybe they like going out to have dinner and they like eating, but really, it's just kind of the permission slip before getting
Look,
to the
I mean,
sex
as
act, just
someone
to be
who once
polite.
got fisted in a car on a first date, I really can't but
I'm
like
laughing so much because I love it. I love
I
that for
have
people.
nothing to say about this.
I'm so happy for you. And I love that that's an experience that people can have. Like, genuinely, I feel like broad conversion in my life for people that are polyamorous and like very happy and fulfilled in their sex life. 'Cause I know how hard that is to find that, especially like we don't get messaging about polyamory. We're not like taught about it as kids explicitly. Like, it's a hard journey to get to this place for a lot of people. But it's just sort of like when the more common poly experience than not is sex on a first date, fisting in a car, whatever it is, like it's like you get treated a little bit differently when you're not that. Like people, I think the main interaction I've had is people are kind of like suspicious that I'm still like prudish and I haven't like fully deconstructed that part of my life yet, and that I haven't had the right partner yet. I haven't used enough different sex toys. I haven't whatever, right? That there's some sort of thing that still needs to be spelunked for, the complete exploration of my sexuality to happen, and they could be the one to unlock it for me. And then once that happens, of course, I will naturally want to have all of the sex all the time with anyone. And it's very difficult, I think, sometimes for people to not project their own sexual experiences onto other people and go, well,
Yes.
but I'm normal and this is what I do. So how are you not doing that? Bizarre.
And you're like, well, I'm a sex educator who has spelunked a lot of depths.
Yeah.
I have a lot of awareness of myself. Sorry. Not
Yeah, that's
sorry.
how I came to this conclusion to begin with. Like, your penis is not going to be the magic key that unlocks a different experience for me, which people don't explicitly generally think. But I've
No.
had, I think, to get into sort of how like partnerships and poly have gone, is sort of why I have this background feeling. It's like at this point, I have like a pretty good initial filter for like within either initially talking or maybe the first date or two, whether or not we're actually compatible to keep spending more time than that, like long term, especially sexually. I have had partners though where I've gotten certain messaging up front about like, oh, like I totally get it. Asexuality is totally fine to me. We never have to do anything you don't want to do. And then like I'm 6 months into a relationship with that person and they do have other partners, they do have other people that they're seeing, but then it becomes a problem. And they were just like, oh, I just thought, if I was around for long enough, like your attitude about this would change. And
I
it's like, this
thought
isn't a
by
time
putting
thing. There's no
enough
timer
goodness
happening.
tokens, then eventually the vagina magic would come out.
Yeah, exactly. They get the gift, they get the reward they've been promised, and it's like, no, this isn't. And I think people don't, they're just not used to interacting with asexuality. So for like, if their dating experience is they've dated 30 women like before me, and then I come along, I'm the only ace person they've ever interacted with, like they're gonna go, okay, yeah, like Deborah and Susie and whoever, like when I dated them, to like 6 months before they warmed up to sex, like initially they told me they weren't really interested in it, and like I just have to play the waiting game again. And so they're kind of using their own previous experience as a rubric for how this experience is going to go. And it's like, no, you need to just write, this is a whole new book we're on. You can't use the old rubric. It's not going to work. Like, I'm going to tell you because they have no interest in wasting either of our times and energy on something that isn't going to work. Just trust me when I tell you how I actually am as a person. And people can be sometimes very reluctant to accept that and understand what it means. And yeah, I don't know. Poly and sex is sort of interesting because of the way the conversations happen about it online is, it seems to always be an eternal war about like, polyamory, is it about sex? Is it about love? No, polyamory is about sex and we need to stop pretending it isn't. And like, it's
I'm
complicated.
on the second team, or rather, I'm on the team of it can be about whatever you want it to be about, right? So, like, it can be about both.
Yeah. I think it can be about whatever you want it to be about, whether it's
You
like,
just pick.
sort of the literal joke of like monogamy in this economy. Like
Right.
if you want to live with four people and you want to be more than just roommates, like
Great.
fantastic, do what you want.
Yeah, exactly. Like, make your choices. They are yours. It's a choose your own adventure story.
Yeah, exactly. Or it should be at least.
Yeah. So I appreciate you coming and chatting with me about all of these things. Where are the places that the listeners can find you?
Yeah, so I am Evie Lupine, EvieLupine, basically everywhere. I'm Evie.Lupine on Instagram. I'm Evie Lupine on Twitter, Evie Lupine on YouTube. I would say my most, I mean, I don't, I kind of equally disuse both Twitter and Instagram at this point, but I'm vaguely on both. My main social media is YouTube, and I post videos twice a week about kink and polyamory. And actually, today I published a video while we're recording this video. Or of recording this podcast that is about polyamory, and it's like it's about the topic of like people that like open up into polyamory after cheating, or go like, my cheating is fine because you need to accept me in my journey of understanding my polyamorous identity. It's like that whole idea and like things I wish people would not confuse with polyamory. So if you're into polyamory stuff, because you listen to this podcast, that video just came out, and it'll probably be quite old by the time this actually gets released, but that's what I've been doing over there.
Great. All of those will be in the show notes, as well as what we're about to be up to, because we are recording this interview like a month early.
Yeah, that's about how it normally goes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I really like a space to be able to talk about these things because, as we've discussed, the internet and other platforms is not always a good place to discuss it these days.
You mean self-hosting is the best way to do
As it turns out, if only it was cheaper.
it? Yeah, exactly. So once again, thanks to Evie for coming on the show. And you can find her on YouTube and on Patreon. We've got all the links in the show notes. So hopefully you've enjoyed listening to the two of us ramble on about all of these topics. And I hope you learned a little something about either the asexual experience in polyamory or some stuff about the way the kink community works and how it intersects with the non-monogamous experience. And if not, I'll be back next week with a polyamory in media with polyanarchy. So have a great week.